Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Michelle Rayner. And today, a journey on the high seas in search of those elusive roaring girls.
Casting off from my snake chamber, I sail with you in sable. Maidens all, our shields shine and we tack and win, then lose to anxious princes. And now, my sovereignty, packed in ice, bleeds in the bay. But my rudder, safely cured in kelp, awaits my daughter's bare, brave hand.
Madame Jungi,
Grace O'Malley,
Anne Bonny,
Sida
Al-Harris,
Charlotte de Berry,
Melissa
Alfield,
Jacot Delahaye.
There was an idea around very much in popular culture of the woman who cross-dresses as a man and goes off to sea. And at the same time, there are also documented stories of women actually having done this.
With jacket blue and trousers white, just like a sailor, neat and tight, the sea was the heart's delight of the rambling female sailor. From stem to stern, she'd boldly go. She'd braved all danger, feared no foe.
The legends are, and the folklore is very, very firm in this, that Grace O'Malley learned her craft as a young child. And we can see her with her father sailing around the coasts of the west coast of Ireland, and indeed further afield to Spain and Portugal, where the clans who were of sea note tended to do business.
If we're really thinking hard about them, we may have to think that these were not nice women. You know, these were real hoodlums.
I'll trample myth's padlocks, though my feet are on brine. I'll sing of my sea skills in no fairground jig time. I'll tell of my voyage as mulled praise and warning. I'll show you my murders and of my heart's deforming.
From the legends of buccaneers and pirates to epic histories of the Imperial Maritime Wars, stories of life at sea have always been peopled by men and marked by the absence of women. Whether it be tales of Viking invaders, murderous Bluebeards and Captain Hooks squaring off against worthy Horatios, the story of the sea has always been crowded with iron men, forever farewelling their wooden women who waited, tied to the shore by some eternal, yet unseeable forces. But what if you threw out this version of the story and went in search of a history of the sea where women were not merely landlocked figurines or wooden mastheads, but instead took flight from shore and indeed sailed, murdered, lived and died way out amid the deep blue briny seas? And once you start looking, you do find stories of women at sea. Sometimes they've been hidden away and must be prized from some sketchy notes of a respected chronicle of maritime history. But they've certainly been recorded in trace memory, in song and in verse. From Artemisia in 5 BC to Madame Jungi Sao and her pirate fleets hundreds of years later, women have always gone to sea for profit and for pleasure. From the early Middle Ages through until the 19th century, the sea was the thread which drove trade and colonial expansion. The black market of the maritime economy, buccaneering or piracy, reached its zenith in the 1700s, when hordes of pirate ships trawled the Caribbean and the Atlantic Oceans in search of booty. And among all the men who took up this sweet trade were some women. And it's the story of these roaring girls that we'll hear about today.
I was interested in the ordinary woman who was a pirate. I was trying to think, what might it have been like for her? What was her financial situation? Did she have to have a lot of sex with a lot of pirates in order to get on that boat?
Historian Jo Stanley has gone in search for women at sea and is co-author of Bold in Her Breeches, Women Pirates Across the Ages.
What I found was a constant pattern in the story of women pirates, that they were sort of ferocious and vicious and more warlike than men, sort of rip-roaring tales that were really not believable about women pirates, and they were very much written by men who didn't seem to have much idea of women's subjective reality.
As always in the moments before battle, Mary felt as taut as a mainsail in a gale. The only noises were the creaking of the hull and the faint slapping oars. The briny tang of the calm, blue-black sea smelt like blood on a hot deck. Orange mats of sargasso weed undulating on the still water stank like putrid flesh, a haunting reminder of all the men that she had slain in the past. Mary shook her head, trying to rid herself of these images. She glanced back to see if her crew were ready. Unlike some others in the Caribbean, the men of the Fury weren't privateers pirating in the service of one of the colonial powers. Her buccaneers, made up of men from many nations, owed their only allegiance to Captain Mary.
So it felt like I was doing a translation job all the time. I was thinking all the time, hey, what could be the reality behind this this version that we're getting of flashing eyes and more vicious than any male pirate and all this sort of version of women pirates that you think this woman pirate is going to be played by Tina Turner or Madonna, the version they're creating of her.
Both of these pirates wore men's jackets and long trousers and handkerchiefs tied about their heads. And each of them had a machete and pistol in their hands and cursed and swore at the men. The reason by which I know and believe them to be women was by the largeness of their breasts.
Piracy has been described as the oldest profession, and so I think we probably could go back to at least 480 BC and Artemisia, who was sailing off the Persian Gulf. And I think we can probably go back earlier than that, but there are no records. And that may be just because women were involved in piracy in a very small-scale way as pirates, wives or mistresses. I think the difference between women engaged with pirates and women engaged with ordinary seafarers is that women who had to do with pirates would benefit from them having large sums of money from time to time, old doubloons.
With pitch and tar, her hands were hard, though once like velvet soft. She weighed the anchor, heaved the lead, and boldly went aloft.
I think women didn't do it just out of economic necessity. I think some were underworld women who just sort of happened into this nearest opportunity to make money. But of course, some of the women were very much involved already as people with power. They were married to the pirate captain. They were women who had authority already, so it was different for them. It was more like working in the family business, like if your dad or your husband owned a very big shop, you might just go into the business too because you knew it and you would know who was cheating. You'd know how to run it properly, you know, you'd know the ropes.
There came to me a most famous feminine sea captain called Granny O'Malley and offered her service unto me, wheresoever I would command her.
No braver
three galleys
seaman
and
took a deck in hurricane or squalls,
either in Ireland or Scotland.
Since Grace O'Malley battered down
this was the most notorious woman
walls.
In all the coasts of Ireland.
I always believed that Grace O'Malley was a woman's man, really. And I mean that in the sense that if you can imagine that against every single cultural, political and social, all the mores of her time, she managed to make herself the accepted leader by a hard-bitten bunch of mixed clansmen who made up her crews. And at one stage she could offer the English Lord Deputy, Sir Henry Sidney at the time, a private army of 200 fighting men.
Grace O'Malley. The story of Gráinne Whale, also known as Grace O'Malley, is central to any history of women and piracy. Born into a seafaring clan family on the west coast of Ireland in the early 1500s, it was preordained that Grace would live and rule as much by sea as by land. But the story of Grace O'Malley chronicles much more than the extraordinary life of a seafaring woman. It reflects the demise of a traditional way of life in the wake of British colonisation of Ireland and the suppression of a whole country under the British Crown. Within this struggle, it's the figure of Gráinne Whale, as the Irish call her, which overshadows all else, like some kind of Gaelic Boadicea.
Irish historian Anne Chambers has written the biography of Grace O'Malley called Gronja Whale.
Pirating really was, to a degree, part and parcel of seafaring everywhere, not just merely in Ireland, but if you ask people down in Cornwall and Devon at the time, for example, or along the coast of Brittany, or indeed off the coasts of Spain, you would find that pirating was part and parcel of everyday seafaring life. However, where Grace O'Malley was concerned, an additional reason, not just because it was traditional in her family, but because of the major maelstrom, political maelstrom, if you like, that occurred in Ireland during the course of her life, led also to the breakdown, really, of the old Gaelic law and order, and into that comes then all kinds of, I suppose, disorder.
At the age of 15, Grace O'Malley married Donal O'Flaherty from another of the chieftain clans on the west coast of Ireland.
The earlier part of her life, including her marriage, her first marriage, is a little bit in the realm of what has been preserved through folklore and tradition, and what impact her husband, her first husband, made in history. And we know for a fact that he made quite a negative impact. He was quite warlike, which indeed wasn't very different for the age, but he in particular was known as Donal an Cogaí, Donal of the Battles. And there are many legends, particularly in the west of Ireland, associated with him, and he met a very sticky end indeed, and Grace was left a widow at a relatively early part of her life.
She left the close-aired land of trees and proud McWilliam's palace for clear, bare Clare's health-salted breeze, her oarsmen and her galleys, and where, beside the bending strand, the rock and billow wrestle, between the deep sea and the land, she built her island castle.
One has to understand that Gaelic Ireland, the laws of Gaelic Ireland were very different to, for example, the laws of England. And when both cultures clashed towards the end of Grace O'Malley's life, in two most significant areas was that divergence most clear, and that one of these was in succession. Now, we have to go back maybe 2,000 years ago when Ireland indeed was ruled by women warrior queens. Christianity, unfortunately, with its attitude towards and mentality towards women, putting them on a par really rather with slaves, soon got rid of that rather liberal attitude to women in Ireland. And after Christianity, we see no woman being legitimately elected chieftain. Now, I stress elected because that was the big difference again between Irish and English law at the time. A chieftain was elected. It was quite a democratic election of a chieftain by his peers. So when Grace O'Malley came to be elected, in inverted commas, she was not only rubbing the noses of the English administrators who had come into her territory by that stage, but also her own indigenous law. She was absolutely saying to them, I am as good as any male chieftain that I see around me, including my former husband, who led his clan into total disarray and weakened them, and I am better than they are. Are as good. And secondly, by sea, I have proved my worth, because she did. Again, the legends are, and the folklore is very, very firm in this, that Grace O'Malley learned her craft as a young child with her father. She did have a half-brother who would seem to have been given more to making music than to sailing ships. And we can see her with her father sailing around the coasts of the west coast of Ireland, and indeed further afield to Spain and Portugal, where the clans who were of sea note tended to do business.
The Spanish captain, sailing by for Newport, with amazement beheld the cannoned longship lie moored to the lady's casement, and, covering coin and cup of gold in haste their hatches under, they whispered, "'Tis a pirate's hold. She sails the seas for plunder." This was the most notorious woman in all the coasts of Ireland. She bought her husband, for she was as well by sea as by land, well more than Mrs. Mate with him. Sir Philip Sidney, Galway, 1577.
But the fact that she could offer an army of 200, private army of 200 men, whom she had moulded into a force whose only loyalty was to her, not to the chieftains in whose clans they were born, but to her, a woman in a man's world. It is absolutely quite extraordinary. And I was speaking about Grace O'Malley for the past 20 years of my life, and every time I think about this, I'm almost without words in awe of the woman when you know the background against which she operated.
'Tis a pirate's hold. She sails the seas for plunder.
Ronuel is coming over the sea with a guard of young soldiers. They are Irish, not English nor Spanish, and they will rout the English.
Her youngest son, her last son, Theobald Burke, he was born at sea as she was returning from one of her voyages. And after the birth, the evening after the birth, as she was resting with her son in her cabin, the ship was attacked by Algerian pirates. So that she roused her men to such a fury that they overcame them. And she said something like, "May you be seven times worse off this day 12 months, who cannot do without me for one day." The one day that she gave birth to her son, her crew couldn't do without her, and she had to be there in person to lead them. And it is a spectacular moment when you can let your mind go and imagine this happening off the coasts of Ireland, Algerian pirates, a woman leader after giving birth to a child. I mean, Hollywood, eat your heart out. The facts far outshine the fiction.
In waters scarlet with slaves' blood, brown with cloves, flecked in gold, I sailed bandanaed. Around me, corsair boys and buccaneers, and in me, a certainty of battle cries.
Grace O'Malley, you can't just look at her merely as a pirate. Certainly she was that, and a very fearless one, and indeed a very daring one. But there's also a huge political dimension to Grace O'Malley, and that's what sets her aside. She led, as she said herself, by land and by sea. She was at home on the waves as much as she was on land, and that was with sword in hand. And, you know, in the various rebellions against individual English governors who came to subdue the province in which she operated, she is there leading three rebellions, actually, against Sir Richard Bingham, who was the governor of Connacht from in the 1580s. She is also there down in Munster, attacking the lands of the Earl of Desmond when he was a little bit shaky in his allegiance. And for that was the one time in her life she was captured and endured imprisonment in Dublin Castle for 18 months.
Welcome, O woman who was sorrowful. We were desolate while you were imprisoned, your lovely country in the hands of vandals, and you yourself sold to the English.
Grace O'Malley confronted her greatest enemy in the form of the English colonial expansion into Ireland. Elizabethan England was determined to bring Ireland under the crown, and driven by land hunger, the colonial forces began to suppress the old Gaelic clan-based rule of the chieftains.
Grace O'Malley, like all the leaders of her time, were now caught in a clash between two opposing forces: the old Gaelic world of chieftains and chieftaincies, of divided loyalties, and the incoming English administration and the armies. So into that, people like Grace O'Malley had to hop from one leg to the other. But really, the odds were against them. And Grace O'Malley was a very astute and pragmatic politician. And she saw really the writing on the wall. And she saw that really, this was the new world that was coming in. She had been abroad. She'd been to Spain. She had been to France. She was, at the end of her life, went to England. So she saw what perhaps the more landlocked chieftains hadn't seen, that there was a world out there and that Ireland had fallen behind. So you have this great maelstrom, really, in every sense, again coming back to what I said, as two cultures collided.
English rule over Ireland was accelerated in 1583 with the appointment of colonial administrator Sir Richard Bingham. His tenure was marked by ongoing conflict and violence. Bingham sought to undermine any vestiges of clan-based rule and singled out Grace O'Malley for particular opprobrium. He claimed that she'd been nurse to all rebellions for the past 40 years.
Bingham had pushed Grace O'Malley and her extended family into a corner to such a degree that Grace was forced to live on one of her ships off the coast. Her husband, her second husband, Richard and Aaron Burke, had done their best, really. They'd sidestepped and then they had gone into outright rebellion simply to hold on to what they had. But Bingham really was too powerful. He was too Machiavellian for them in many respects. And he seemed to have an utter hatred of Grace. Now, he was very much antagonistic in his writings and his letters, particularly to Grace. He couldn't fathom this she-devil out at all.
In the contest with Richard Bingham over land and sovereignty, Grace O'Malley decided that the only weapon left to her was the English law. So she went to the very core of power in Elizabethan England, the Queen herself.
Because he had pushed her so much, what did Grace O'Malley do? And this again shows the great political acumen of the woman. She's second to none, really, in the Machiavellian world of European politics at the time. She sits down, she says, where can I go from here? Bingham is in the ascendancy here. I cannot get to anybody to call him off and call his war dogs off. I cannot get to anybody in Ireland because he is the premier guy in my neck of the woods. So what did she do? She said, OK, I'll go to his boss, basically. Go over his head, go to his boss. Now, that sounds a very simple thing to do, but as we all know, to get to Queen Elizabeth, indeed to get to any monarch, even in present-day times, is a very, very difficult thing, and you can't literally walk in off the street. Now, where the legends and the facts relating to Grace O'Malley's extraordinary meeting with Queen Elizabeth I in 1593 differ is the legends love to say that dressed in her Irish costume, Grace stormed up the Thames with her fleet of galleys and her hard-bitten crews. Well, of course, it didn't happen like that at all. Grace O'Malley, as I say, was the pragmatic politician. She sought out an Irish earl, the Black Tom, the Earl of Ormond, who through his Boleyn connections was a cousin of Queen Elizabeth I and would have been one of her favourites at the court. As you know, Elizabeth picked her favourites rather as like we pick dresses from month to month. Well, Black Tom was the flavour of the month for her at the time, and Grace O'Malley knew that. And she sailed down to Black Tom's castle, which is down south of Ireland in Carrigonshore, got a letter of introduction to Queen Elizabeth, and before she set off, sent over a petition to Elizabeth, and it makes most extraordinary reading. She's asking Queen Elizabeth to protect Grace, who has been proven to have been now a rebel, a pirate and everything else, to protect her from Queen Elizabeth's own general in Connacht.
To grant unto your said subject your most gracious hand of signed free liberty during her life to invade with sword and fire all of the enemies of your highness, wheresoever they are or shall be.
Now, one would imagine that Queen Elizabeth would have binned the letter and said, crazy woman, and sent more troops to Bingham to most certainly get her, but she didn't. Instead, her astute statesman, Burley, sent Grace 18 questions. It was rather like filling in an application form. And the questions are extremely basic and some of them then very, very interesting, like who her mother and father was, how many children she had, how many husbands she had, how many castles she had. Well, that was, she skirted around that one very, very well. How much land she had, how many ships she had, all the usual things. And the answers shows the wiliness of Grace. You know, she, because the English mispronounced some of her castles, she says, well, I haven't a clue what you mean, really. I don't know any castle of that name. So eventually, in about July 1593, she was asked to come to Queen Elizabeth. And certainly she sailed her own ship up the Thames, and the court had moved to Greenwich for the summer, as it tended to do. And this extraordinary meeting of two of the most remarkable women of the period took place, and I suppose it is very fitting that they did eventually meet, and I think very fitting as well that both of them were very old women at the time, because really I think they had seen so much and seen through so much, and seen themselves, I think, had been to a degree misused by men. And I love this because here you have two women now, one caked with makeup, rice powder, rouged cheeks, and dressed in the ultra fashion of the day, which, as we all know from the portraits of Queen Elizabeth, was quite, to say the least, flamboyant. And here on the other side, you had this weather-beaten, grey-haired woman. who had seen a life that nobody really in that court who watched her come forward to see Queen Elizabeth could even contemplate, who had rode the waves off the west coast of Ireland, who had gone through the Bay of Biscay. Grace O'Malley had sailed the seas, and the seas had really, you could see it in her weather-beaten face.
To invade with sword and fire all of the enemies of your highness, wheresoever they are or shall be, without the interruption of any person or persons whatsoever.
Now, Grace asked Elizabeth that she be allowed to continue without any interference, yes, from any person whatsoever, to be allowed return to her trade of maintenance by land and sea. Now, Elizabeth fell for this hook, line and sinker. And basically what Grace O'Malley got from her was that she could basically go back to exactly what she had been doing before Bingham had stopped her. And Grace continued. And incidentally, the last known entry in the English state papers of Grace's exploits is 1597. That is 4 years after her visit to Queen Elizabeth, where she is reported after having plundered the Isle of Barra off the coast of Scotland in a retaliatory attack for the chieftain of Barra having done likewise to her in Mayo. The last entry relating to Grace O'Malley's activities by sea, at least, ended in Scotland.
"'Tis a pirate's hold. She sails the seas for plunder."